are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. South Florida in the 70s was one of the nation's most dangerous locations. Behind the image of sun and surf, young women were the victims of a brutal killer. In the mid-70s, over a dozen young women were murdered and found in canals. These cases became known as the Flat Tire Murders and the Canal Murders. Only one case was ever solved. More than four decades have passed since these crimes, and no arrests were ever made. This is the first book to explore these murders in depth, as well as a bizarre series of murders occurring in the years earlier, known as the Gold Sock Stranglings. Interviews with the detectives that originally worked to solve these cases provide an intimate view of the attempt to capture the killer that terrorized South Florida. In addition to the cases themselves, the book explores several suspects, including the infamous serial killer Ted Bundy. Detailed maps of South Florida illustrate the complex canal system that became the victim's graveyard. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Flat Tire Murders, Unsolved Crimes of a South Florida Serial Killer. Special guest, journalist and author, Michael P. Burns. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Michael P. Burns.
Thank you, Dan. It's a real pleasure to be here.
Thank you so much. Very, very interesting case and corresponding book. Let's get right to where you grew up and your connection to this story.
I grew up in Miami in the 1980s and 1990s, and I really didn't have a connection to this particular series of murders until fairly recently. As I talk about in the book, one of the pivotal events in my childhood was the execution and the surrounding chaos regarding Ted Bundy in 1989. So that really struck a nerve and kind of brought to my attention that there are dangerous people out there and bad things happen. But other than that, growing up in Miami, it was very little crime, at least where I was, and a very enjoyable childhood that I had there. So it wasn't until recently that I even became aware of what was going on there in the 1970s.
You say that you write that your interest in these cases, the canal murders and the flat tire murders, converge with the arrest of the Golden State Killer. Tell us why.
Well, I've been following true crime for years now, and the East Area Rapist and the Golden State Killer were his monikers, and I became aware of him around 2016 or so. This was before an arrest was made, and I thought the cases were extremely interesting. There were very little in terms of physical descriptions. It was just this sort of ghost that was floating around California in the 1970s and early 1980s. And I, like I said, became aware of this case, and I also became aware of the public interest in this case. It sort of took on a life of its own, and in 2016, the California Department of Justice sort of brought this case to public attention and said, we're looking for this guy. We, 30-plus years later, we have not forgotten. This is an active case. And that really caught my attention as well. So it kind of converged with law enforcement pushing for an arrest, as well as the public interest in the case. And I thought, once there was an arrest, it really was a awakening for me that cases from 40 years ago can still be solved.
Now, what is the purpose of writing this book primarily, other than just to tell this story that's untold and people, for the most part, it's unknown? But what do you hope to gain from writing this book?
I hope the same thing that happened with the East Area Rapist and the Golden State Killer, to bring public attention to these cases and ultimately to have some sort of resolution in terms of solving the cases, if possible. And I do realize the limitations of law enforcement, but the fact that these cases have just sort of been forgotten really struck a nerve with me. And so I definitely want the public to know that these cases happened and these victims are not forgotten.
Right. Now, in this book, these South Florida canals are, you write, as abundant as palm trees and swimming pools. Tell us about these South Florida canals. What is their purpose and why are they so prominent?
Yeah, the canals in South Florida are ubiquitous. You'll drive a few miles and you'll see several, you know, along the way. They basically drain the marshy land of South Florida out to the Atlantic Ocean. They also provide defense against potential flooding due to hurricanes, which, you know, you'll have a severe hurricane like the one in the 1920s that killed thousands of people. So they were designed to drain South Florida, make it inhabitable land, which it did, and there are 2,600 miles of canals crisscrossing South Florida like veins and arteries, and they all sort of move the water westward to eastward out to the Atlantic Ocean. So the canals are everywhere, and I remember, you know, as a child, they were a lot of fun for fishing. There was always a place to go if you wanted to fish. But they were dangerous as well. You know, kids would sometimes fall in, but they were just a part of life, and they still remain a part of life for most people in South Florida.
You talk about South Florida crime explosion in the 70s. Tell us a little bit about that explosion and how canals were involved as well.
Well, yeah, going back to the canal, just to point out that they get dredged, and they are basically, when they dredge them, they find everything from airplanes to parts to rockets, cars, bodies. The canals are basically a dumping ground for people that want to either get rid of stuff or stuff that they don't want anyone to ever find. So they really are quite interesting when they're dredged. You'll find pretty much everything. But in the 1970s, there was a huge explosion of crime in South Florida, particularly Dade and Broward County. And it was shocking to me because I had a sort of bucolic view of South Florida back then. But in terms of crime, in 1975, Florida itself had the third highest crime rate in the United States. And in 1975, Dade was the fourth in crimes per capita, and Broward was sixth in the United States. So there was definitely a huge crime explosion that I think gets foreshadowed a bit, overlooked because of the 1980s drug epidemic and crime surrounding that. But as I note in the book, even before the 1980s, crime was off the charts in South Florida.
Mm-hmm. You write about in the 60s, and you chronicle these spectacular cases and the victims. Before we get to the canal murders and the flat tire murders of 1975 and 1976. So tell us why they were dubbed the canal murders and the flat tire murders before we start going through the victims and what happened in early 1975.
Yeah, they got the name the canal murders because all of the victims were found either near or in canals, with one or two exceptions. But it was basically a series of young girls, all sort of fitting a general appearance, some as young as 14. There were three that were 14 years old that were found in or near canals in 1975, one after the other. So they got the name the canal murders by the local media back then. The flat tire murders were sort of a subset of those murders, and they occurred in the summer of 1975 when two women, Ronnie Gorlin and Elise Rapp, were basically tricked because their car tires were deflated at a mall in Dade County, and their bodies were found the next day in canals, and police I think, logically concluded that the tires were deflated, they were offered help, and then they were murdered. So those are the flat tire murders.
Mm-hmm. Let's go through some of the canal murders and the characteristics of the killer and some of the characteristics of the victims.
Sure. Like I mentioned, the victims were quite young. Three of them were 14 years old. One was 17. Two were 19. So these were young women. They were not prostitutes or drug addicts. They were pretty much suburban teenage girls. Some were engaged to be married. One was married. But there were no issues in terms of, drug abuse or anything like that. And they were all found, like I said, in canals in South Florida. Different ways that they were killed, but sort of through 1975, a series of young women in the suburbs were murdered and found in canals.
Mm-hmm. How do the police begin their investigation in those murders? You mentioned one crime that was solved, and that's Judith Ann Osterling from Rushville, Indiana. So tell us what exactly these women were, where they were in their lives, where they were in a position to be
sure.
approached. What was the approach?
Sure. Judith Osterling was 19 years old. She was from Indiana, and she kind of left Indiana and came down to Florida to look for adventure, look for her new life. And she began working at a health spa, which was sort of a generic term that was given to places that sometimes were fronts for prostitution. We don't know what she did at the place that she worked, but in January 1975, she was found nude in a canal along U.S. 27, drowned and beaten. So that was really the first case that got the attention of law enforcement. And they put a lot of effort into investigations, investigating different suspects, working the case, and it eventually paid off later, but again, that was the only case that was ever solved.
Mm-hmm. Then you talk about Barbara Davis Stevens, who's 23 years old, and she was last seen February 12, 1975. What was the details of her murder?
Well, Barbara was a Miami native. She was married to her high school sweetheart, but they had separated, and he had moved to Hollywood, California. On February 12, 1975, she went to the Gold Triangle department store near Dayland Mall in Miami. She made a purchase of two rock and roll records, and she disappeared. Her body wasn't found until several days later out behind a shopping center a couple miles away, and the autopsy determined that she had been stabbed multiple times. She was a very attractive young woman, blonde-haired, with roots in Miami, through her father. So she was a native. She was not like Judith Osterling, who sort of had set up shop in South Florida. She was a native, and her murder was really heavily investigated. They eventually found her body after extensive searches.
Mm-hmm. And there was another aspect to it as well, that someone had said something that police considered he must have been a witness, and then there was a message on the concrete wall as well. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Police were looking into clues and interviewing people after they found her body, and they noticed that a magic marker had been used to write the following words on a wall: "A girl was killed here, and I saw it," with an exclamation point after it, which clearly would get law enforcement's attention. They put a lot of effort into finding out who possibly could have written that, and eventually determined that it was a prank from a teenager who broke down in tears when he was finally confronted by law enforcement about that. But that just kind of shows the kind of directions that the cases went in. There would sometimes be some hot leads, but they would be pursued, but they never really amounted to much, except in Judith Osterling's case.
Mm-hmm. After Barbara Stevens' murder in Miami, you write about Arietta Marie Shaw Tinker, 17. She was last seen on April 9th at a restaurant that was known to be frequented by the Outlaws Motorcycle Club. What happened to her? When was she found? Give us the particulars.
Yes, Arietta Tinker was a 17-year-old married woman. She was a mother as well. She had an infant at home, and she was dropped off at the Hippopotamus restaurant in Fort Lauderdale. And after spending a day there and a day at the beach, she disappeared, and she was eventually found in the Snake Creek Canal near U.S. 27 on April 9th, 1975. And it was really unclear as to the cause of death. Eventually, it was determined that she drowned, and it was unclear whether there was foul play. But it leads to a serious question. How did this woman with no car end up drowned in a very, very remote canal near U.S. 27?
Judith Osterling was also found in the Snake Creek Canal. Is that correct?
That's correct. And that's the canal that's parallel to U.S. 27. And I talk about U.S. 27 in the book. It's a very isolated road. It really is just a corridor between Central Florida down to Dade and Broward counties. There's a lot of agriculture around there, sugarcane, things like that, but it's really not a road that you pull off of and stop for shopping or anything. It's a really isolated road. So to be found out there in that canal was definitely unusual.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned now Nancy Lee Fox was 19 years old, and this is June 14th, and very much different than Arietta Marie Tinker. This person was walking home. How was she found, and what were some of the differences, especially from Arietta, in terms of condition?
Sure. Nancy was 19 years old, and she sort of had a troubled relationship with her boyfriend and her sister. And on June 14th, 1975, she disappeared while walking at night in Fort Lauderdale. And she was found a few days later, again, in a canal near U.S. 27, near the Sawgrass Recreational Area, which is sort of a public park. They have airboat rides, things like that. But again, a very remote area. And Nancy had been hit on the head and choked. So there's a difference between her murder and Arietta Tinker's, where Miss Tinker simply was drowned out in that remote canal. But in this case, there was definitely signs of foul play with being hit on the head and choked.
You write that the public is becoming aware of around this time, and then you introduced Barbara Schreiber, 14, and Belinda Zetterover, 14, who are friends. Tell us what happens on June 18th, fateful night.
Well, yes, this was the case that really indicated that there was something going on, because these two girls, Barbara Schreiber and Darlene Zetterauer, were 14-year-old friends in the Fort Lauderdale area. And on June 18th, 1975, they told their parents that they were going to spend the night at each other's houses, and it was sort of a lie. They wanted to get out and walk around and have some fun. And they disappeared, and it was unclear as to whether they were trying to hitchhike, but they were found the following day, again at a canal along U.S. 27, both shot to death. And really, no motive. Police interviewed, you know, all kinds of individuals, including their friends, and really there was nothing to go on except for a clue that was found that turned out to be a dead end. So they were both shot in June of 1975.
Mm-hmm. You read about next about Robin Leslie Losh. She's 14 years old, and she vanishes on July 8th. Tell us what her condition is, and is there any connection with these other bodies that are, like you write, only 5 miles south of where Belinda Zetterauer and Barbara Schreiber and Nancy Fox were discovered?
Well, yeah, Nancy Fox and Barbara Schreiber and Darlene Zetterauer were found very close together in the canal near US 27. So it sort of seemed that there was a spot that someone or some people were deciding to dispose of bodies in this very remote area. But Robin, Ms. Zetterauer and Ms. Schreiber was only 14. She was walking on July 8th, 1975, and she disappeared. She was discovered 2 days later, again in the canal near US 27, and they determined that she drowned, and it was unclear as to whether there was any foul play. So kind of like the death of Arietta Tinker, a girl 14 years old with no car is found drowned in a very, very remote canal in far western Broward County.
And you write as well that it was suspicious because she drowned, but she was an excellent swimmer. Let's get to Ronnie Sue Gorlin, a 27-year-old, very integral part to this. Well, everyone's important in this story, but she's especially important in this story. July 22nd, she disappeared. What was different about her condition of her body? What had happened?
Well, Ronnie was one of the older victims. She was 27 years old. She was engaged to be married to a man in Pennsylvania, and she was back in South Florida with her family in Hollandale. And on June 22nd, 1975, she visited her mother in the hospital. And actually, she was going to visit her mother. She never showed up. They later found her car at the 163rd Street Mall with a flat tire, and she was gone. They eventually found her body nude out in the canal in western Dade County a few days later. And the connection with the subsequent murder of Elise Rapp, which we'll talk about in a minute, really told the police there was something sinister going on. There was somebody using this tactic to abduct women.
Mm-hmm. Now, you write at this time, not at this time, but you write about 2020 that there's a police officer named Charles Musseline believed that Ted Bundy was the best suspect in Ronnie's death. Is this because of the bite marks?
Yeah, the bite marks, as well as the MO of approaching a woman in a parking lot, offering to provide assistance, definitely told this detective that Bundy needed to be considered as a possibility. There were bite marks on Ronnie Gorlin. She had been bitten, choked, and drowned. And those bite marks eventually were compared, from what I can tell, to Christopher Wilder and Ted Bundy. Doesn't appear that there's anything more in the records that I reviewed as to whether there was a match or they couldn't compare them. But yes, the bite marks as well as the MO indicated that Ted Bundy was definitely a viable suspect.
Now, 1 week after Ronnie Gorlin was dumped in a canal, you say he struck again, the killer struck again, with nearly the same method of killing. And we talked about Elsie Rapp, 21 years old. What was the near same method or identical method in your eyes and other people's minds?
Yeah, Elise Rapp was 21 years old, and she was from New York, and she really enjoyed South Florida, so she was working down here as a secretary. And on July 30th, 1975, 8 days after Ronnie Gorlin was murdered, Elise left her home and never came back. And police eventually found her car, again, at the 163rd Street Mall with a flat tire. She was found the following day in basically the same canal as Ronnie Gorlin. She also had been hit on the head and drowned, and there were marks on her that indicated this was a sexual assault. So the MO of flattening a tire and offering assistance or somehow getting these women to come with the killer was almost identical. Bodies were placed in nearly the same location. Interestingly, they both had E license plates on their car, which indicated that they were rentals or leases. Mm-hmm. There were definitely similarities that police picked up on, and their conclusions to this day were that those two were definitely related, as were some others, but these are definitely the strongest that are related.
Mm-hmm. And Elise had also been sexually mutilated as well as Ronnie Gorlin as well. That was one of the characteristics, wasn't it?
Correct. Elise Rapp, her genitals were stabbed, and there was definitely a conclusion by the Dade County Medical Examiner that the bite marks on Ronnie Gorlin and the mutilation of Elise Rapp connected them in terms of both being sex crimes, both being very aggressive attacks, very sadistic attacks on these women. So, yeah, there were definitely markers that were similar between both.
You say, too, that the girls looked alike in appearance, but for some reason, maybe you can explain this, the composites drawings were not released publicly.
Yeah, the composites were never publicly released. Law enforcement did take some of the composites, especially in the two flat tire murders, to people at the 163rd Street Mall. They interviewed them, tried to get an idea of who may have been around when these murders occurred. But really, nothing ever, at least publicly, came of this in terms of descriptions or possible vehicles. But there were some composites that were alluded to, at least, but they were not released publicly.
Mm-hmm. Now, the police are beginning their investigation. The Miami News offers a reward of $6,000. Dozens write in describing their attacks, being followed by suspicious men in flat tires in shopping centers. And the fall of 1975, you write, brought more bodies. One particular, Linda Ann Hamilton, 16 years old. What were the particulars, if there was any difference, in this crime with Linda?
Well, Linda was found a bit further north in Florida, kind of a similar situation where a young girl was found murdered and dumped. Eventually, Gerald Stano, who was a Florida serial killer at the time, who confessed later to 41 murders, admitted in 1981 that he had killed Linda. But at the time, police were looking anywhere, thinking that maybe this killer had moved north in Florida. But eventually, Mr. Stano did confess, and he was executed in Florida in 1998.
You write there was another body in December 1975. You say that by the end of 1975, how many young women were connected or were murdered in that time span with only one case solved?
With only one case solved, there were at least 13 victims, and we'll go through some more, but five were definitely linked, at least by the medical examiner, as definitely being related. But there were 13 victims in 1975 and early 1976 in Dade and Broward County.
Right. And for police, they did realize that it was the same person that killed Ronnie Gorton and Elise Rapp. Is that correct?
That's correct. They definitely linked those two cases, and as the police were trying to put together the puzzle, they were looking at these other murders. All of them shared similar characteristics in terms of the victims, the locations that the bodies were found. These girls basically just disappeared. There was no evidence of any kind of altercation or abduction. These were not home invasions or anything of that sort. It really seemed that, at least from my review of the case, this was somebody who was decent looking, a good talker, could get these women to become comfortable and come with him and before he murdered them. So they were definitely connecting the Gorlin and Rapp cases and putting these other killings that occurred very near in time all together as a series of murders.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is ZipRecruiter. According to Forbes, Gyms, nail salons, hotels, mom-and-pop stores, and more are set to go on an epic hiring spree in the coming months to meet the pent-up demand for all of these services. I was excited, like everyone, to be able to go see a movie at the movie theater. I got to see some stand-up. I went back to my gym and had a sauna after a long time. I had all kinds of businesses that I had frequented before I went back to. And all of these business reopening means that millions of jobs will need to be filled. So where do these businesses turn to fill these roles fast? ZipRecruiter. And right now you can try it for free at ziprecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, they send your job to over 1,000 top job sites, giving you access to their network of millions of job seekers. ZipRecruiter's matching technology scans resumes to find qualified candidates for your open roles and proactively presents them to you. You can easily review recommended candidates and invite your top choices to apply for your job, which encourages them to apply faster. ZipRecruiter's technology is so effective that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ziprecruiter.com/murder. That's ziprecruiter.com/MURDER. Just go to ziprecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, when we last left off, we were still in 1975. You write that there was 2 full-time detectives working the case. You had Broward County and Dade County police and law enforcement. And disabling a victim's car was a definite M.O. among certain officers and law enforcement. And there was enough similarities, you write, to possibly link 5 Dade and Broward County cases, perhaps even 12. So how do police proceed, and what happens in their investigation with the body count?
Well, police really, to quote one of them, worked their butts off. There were tons of interviews. They basically contacted every registered sex offender, attempted to go through the case files and find some similarities and find some evidence that would lead them to a possible suspect or a person of interest. But really, there was not a lot in terms of progress in these cases in 1975 and 1976. So it was a lot of legwork. It was a lot of interviews, a lot of file review meetings, sort of hitting the ground and trying to find whether there were any witnesses to any of these abductions. So there was a lot of work done, but there was not a lot of results for it.
You talk about Judith Osterling, the 22-year-old that was killed and thrown in the canal. A person confessed to the crime. Who was that? Tell us that incredible story.
Well, as these canal murders were piling up, the first murder that really kind of set everything off was Judith Osterling in January of 1975. And by the end of 1975, police, to their great credit, had been working these cases, you know, not putting them on the shelf, putting a lot of effort into solving them. They went back to Judith's boss, to her place of employment at the Tiger Health Spa in Dade County. And under interrogation, they eventually got a confession from Sue Jane Walter. She confessed that she and her boyfriend had killed Judith and dumped her body in the canal next to US 27 as the result of a sexual assault that Judith attempted to resist.
Yes. So now you have victims Marlene Annabelli, 26 years old. She was last seen October 22nd. Pardon me. And reported missing October 25th. What is the state of her before we talk about Mary Coppola, Michelle Winters, and Anna Lee Murata Mims? What are some of the characteristics of their killings?
Well, Marlene was 26 years old, and she was married but estranged from her husband, and she had purchased a vacation package, so she came down from up north to have a short vacation in Fort Lauderdale. And She was missing from her hotel for several days until she was found on October 22, 1975, out in a field in western Broward County. She had been strangled with rope, and police suspected that she might have been abducted somewhere either on the beach or near the beach when she was out there. So, again, they found the body. They found that she was strangled, but there really were no leads in that case either.
Mm-hmm. So you talk about Mary Coppola and Michelle Winters. What was their fate, and if there was any difference in some of the conditions where they were found or the conditions in which they were killed?
Well, Mary was only 15 years old, Mary Coppola. She was going to a teen counseling center. She had run away from home previously, but again, nothing really too out of the ordinary in terms of her lifestyle. And she had a family at home. And on September 2nd, 1975, she disappeared on her way to that counseling center. And she was not found until New Year's Day of 1976. She was near a canal, but the location was in Homestead, which is the far south of Dade County. So not in the same location as the other victims, but again, fitting the age profile in the method of just simply disappearing while walking somewhere leads to the conclusion that she may have been talked into going with someone.
Mm-hmm. You read about Michelle Winters, 17. She was last seen December 30th, and her body was found January 10th, floating again in the Snake Creek Canal, strangled with her purse strap around her neck, also a scarf around her neck. Many of these women are in the water, clothed, but also there is something that it speaks to trophy keeping. Tell us about the jewelry. Something's missing, something remains.
Yes, in the flat tire murders of Ronnie Gorlin and Elise Rapp, Ronnie was missing a sandal. Some other victims were missing earrings. They were found with one earring, and the other one was missing. And small little items from the victims were unaccounted for. In Michelle's case, there was a ring that she always had that was taken. And it sort of leads to the conclusion that these were definitely taken by whoever killed them as potential trophies or to remind them of what they did. So Michelle had a missing ring that she had gotten from her father. She never took it off, and it was missing. So yeah, there's definitely evidence of somebody taking items from the victims when he leaves them.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that with many of these victims, there are differences in this, and some of the people that were able to describe this perpetrator. You cite cases along in this investigation where a black man is involved. So there is different descriptions of perpetrators, and so many cases, again, involving the canal. You also have cases where disabling vehicles in different ways. So it seems incredible to me, and as you go along in the book, then you start talking about possible suspects in this, which include the very famous Ted Bundy, but also people like Stano and Christopher Wilder and other infamous serial killers that certainly possibly could have operated at the same time in the same area. So what are some of the things that police are faced at? Again, this you talk about that after 1976, that basically this thing went cold, didn't it?
Right. There was a lot of effort put into these cases in 1975, and that dropped down in 1976, the effort that was able to be put into these cases. And I think when you look back at the crime explosion in South Florida in the 1970s, it was simply overwhelming. So there was only so much, so many resources that could be put towards these cases, and they went from hot to warm to cooling off, and then eventually cold as they are today. So police were not able to devote endless time and resources as there were new cases rolling in constantly. So by the end of 1976, these cases sort of remained a curiosity. What happened? Why did all of this happen in 1975? And they were no closer to getting their suspect than they were at the beginning, with the exception of Judith Osterling's case.
Mm-hmm. Now, as time went on, there were suspects in this case, and you chronicle all of the viable suspects that police considered. But tell us about the case of the Kirky case, as you call it, in 1975. Sal Leon, a cop, had gone to the scene of a woman named Kirky's mutilated body in the canal and took photos. Tell us about this incredible suspect and this case of this young woman thrown in a canal.
Yes, Judith Kersey was murdered in 1977, and 1978, and she was found also in the canal near U.S. 27. She was a bit older; she was 32, but there were signs that she was sexually mutilated, and definitely a sex crime. And in 1985, a former police officer named Sal Leon was showing photographs of Ms. Kersey's body to various women, which got him in trouble. But it turns out in 1978, he went to the scene of Ms. Kersey's the recovery of her body and had some photographs. So it was a very bizarre incident as to why he would be displaying these photographs. Nothing ever came of it. He was never charged with anything, related to any homicides. But it was just a very bizarre incident, one of several in terms of suspects in this case, because police would get a sort of a whiff of somebody being involved, but it never turned into anything concrete.
Mm-hmm. Like many people, and we talked about the East Area Rapist Golden State Killer case, that advances in DNA near the turn of the century interested police enough to say that possibly some of these cases could be opened up again with the latest DNA technology. Tell us a little bit about that hope and what DNA may find in this particular case.
Well, yeah, the Golden State Killer case, when it was when D'Angelo was arrested in 2018, really shocked me that something that old could be solved. And in these cases, based upon reviewing the medical examiner's reports, it appears that there could be biological evidence that was taken, whether it's been preserved properly or what the condition of it. I still don't know at this point, but there is definitely an indication that. These crimes were treated as sex crimes, and they went through the standard sex crime evidence gathering techniques in the 1970s. So assuming that those samples are still preserved, I would think and hope that something can be done with DNA, perhaps similar to what eventually caught Joseph DeAngelo.
Mm-hmm. Let's use an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Besides the incredible amount of victims and the differences between the victims and the different areas where these victims were attacked in some cases, you also had suspicion that this killer traveled somewhere else and committed crimes in other areas, and there are crimes that share similarities to the Flat Tire murders and the Canal murders. In that, you look at, and we mentioned earlier about the infamous Ted Bundy being considered in a couple of these murders or many of these murders, but also some other infamous serial killers were considered, including Gerard Schaefer and Steno, Christopher Wilder. Tell us about some of these people and why they were considered and in what way.
Yeah, Christopher Wilder and Ted Bundy were the two names that came up in the medical examiner's notes in the Flat Tire cases. Christopher Wilder was a serial killer who began his crime spree in 1984, and which ended with his suicide. But he killed a number of girls across the country, and he he was similar to Bundy in that he would be very presentable and would present himself as a talent agent or a modeling agent, and was able to talk women into coming with him. And he worked and lived in Broward County in the 1970s. During that time, there were rape accusations. There was a kidnapping case that was brought against him, kidnapping a 16-year-old and a 17-year-old. So at least by 1980, Wilder was moving towards more serious crimes. So he was there in the 1970s and definitely deserved some attention, and they did give him attention from what I've seen in the reports.
What about Ted Bundy? You talk about an officer that was asking for specifics from Ted Bundy, and Ted Bundy then said to them, said to this person, if I get convicted of the Leach case, Leach murder, I will tell you. What happened from that agreement? What was gained, if anything, from that?
Well, Ted Bundy is a very interesting suspect. A lot of people don't know that he had been in Miami in 1968 when he was 22 years old as a delegate for Nelson Rockefeller's Republican nomination. So he had been to Miami in the 1960s. When he was captured and tried in Miami in 1979, a detective who investigated the Flat Tire murders went to go speak with Bundy at his jail cell in Dade County, and based on the detective's recollection of the event, it seemed like Bundy had some understanding, and it struck a nerve with him regarding the Flat Tire murders. And he said, "Yes, I'll speak with you about that if I'm convicted." But nothing ever came of it afterwards. And we all know that Bundy, especially during his time in prison, liked to play games with police. So whether there was any veracity behind that statement, we'll probably never know. But there was definitely interest in Bundy in the Flat Tire murders, also because of the bite marks that were found on Ronnie Gorlin.
There were more than the one police officer, though, that believed that Bundy was responsible. Just other than the bite mark, was there any other reason why?
Well, the two detectives who are still alive, both to this day, believe that Ted Bundy was fit the profile to a T. They both believe that the same modus operandi that Bundy used in his Western United States murders was almost identical to what happened to Elise Rapp and Ronnie Gorlin when their cars were disabled. Being able to talk a woman into coming with them definitely fit Bundy's profile. And from the medical examiner reports, they did look at Bundy based upon those bite marks. Now, whether that indicated that he was involved or not, he always denied to the end that there was nothing in Miami that he was guilty of. So, but these detectives believe to this day that it was likely him.
You include, and we didn't talk about this, but in the beginning of the book, you talk about the Gold Sock stranglings and the Miami Strangler. Why, before we talked about the Canal murders and the Flat Tire murders, did you include these crimes in this book?
Sure. Well, it really set the scene as far as the crime explosion in South Florida in the 1970s. Before the Canal murders and the Flat Tire murders, there was a series of six stranglings, all of which involved a sock being tied around a woman's neck. So there were a number of victims, and that occurred in 1973. Preceding that was an incident known as the Miami Strangler from 1964 to 1970. There were about 10 victims in those cases. They all were identified as being similar and being connected, but never conclusively. And I think that's a limitation based on the forensic evidence gathering tools that were available in the 1970s. But definitely patterns of murders over a distinct period of time were identified even before the Flat Tire and Canal murders occurred.
You write about the flat tire murders, and you include, interestingly, in the book, just to add tension, in that there are many other criminals that are caught, that are arrested, that are suspected, that escape. But you illustrate that with some of these perpetrators showing, say, a police badge. So when you talk about the flat tire murders and the disablement of these vehicles, it comes to mind Hillside Strangler and so that sort of MO. Do you think that the police ruse might have been part of these abductions, kidnappings?
Definitely. I think that's a possibility. I think a good illustration is Ted Bundy's arrest in 1975 in Utah when he attempted to abduct and murder Carol DeRanche. What he did was walked up to her and told her car was had been broken into and she needed to come with him because he's an undercover cop and we're going to fill out a report. She eventually asked him, when she got a little suspicious, do you have any identification? And he flashed a badge at her, and of course it was a fake badge, and she continued to go with him. So I think in these cases in South Florida, there's definitely the possibility that these young girls that were, you know, some of them 14 years old, 15, 17, would respond to somebody in a position of authority or pretending to be in a position of authority to get them to go with them.
You write about the flat tire murders and the canal murders. You say that they may be entirely unrelated or not. Tell us about this conundrum.
Yes, and that's really the puzzle of this case is which victims are connected and how. The Dade County Medical Examiner believed, based on the medical evidence, that five of them were connected. I think the two strongest that were connected were Elise Rapp and Ronnie Gorlin. Those were nearly identical crimes, both cars at the 163rd Street Mall, flat tires, and found eight days apart. So regardless of how many cases are connected and how strong, I definitely believe that there was somebody in South Florida at this time with the intent of abducting and murdering women.
You know, when I look at all the similarities between some of these serial killers, and you want to just chalk it up to coincidence, but is there the possibility that they read the news like everyone else, and they're even more avid fans of true crime reporting? Would they be influenced? Would they take clues? Would they want to be included? Would they try to throw the scent off themselves by having similarities to these known killers that are being hunted? Is there any of that in this?
I think I think you put it very well, and it reminds me of Joseph DeAngelo, who was a police officer, and he knew what jurisdictions to go in. He knew the procedures for criminal investigations, and he used that to his advantage to do what he did and evade capture. I think something similar may have occurred in these cases where, like you said, somebody was very aware of what clues were being gathered, who was being interviewed. And I think also another factor is perhaps there was a knowledge that putting bodies in water is a good way to get rid of some forensic evidence. So
yes,
I think that there was definitely somebody that was very sophisticated. It wasn't a psychopath. It wasn't a deranged person, which some of the media at the time kind of tried to play this up as. It was really
right.
A cold, calculating person like a Bundy or some of these other serial killers that plan things out and are very careful about what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. You talk about the DNA technology possibilities. Do you know the status of that there is enough, as you write, enough biological evidence to be able to conduct DNA tests? And do you know the status of that testing?
Well, that's a great question, and I've dug plenty in terms of trying to get the medical or the evidence from the police, and When I was doing this, it was during the COVID epidemic, and things really slowed down quite dramatically. So there was a limit on what was available, but I definitely think that some of these cases have evidence that can still be tested, and I think that's reflected also in the some of the cases like James Rose, who was recently confessed to a 1975 murder in 2018
right.
based upon DNA. So they're doing it. Law enforcement is looking at this DNA route as a way to solve these cases.
Mm-hmm. You say that even if DNA technology cannot capture this killer, and of course we get back to the purpose of your book and very fascinating in-depth analysis, what else can happen in your mind? You talk about that maybe something's in someone's attic that they might not have considered before. Tell us what might happen in your mind from this.
What might happen is somebody who knows something may be triggered and remember an event, a person, an item that may be significant that maybe they forgot about or discarded in years past, and they may come forward, even if there is no DNA evidence, to at least have these cases in the public discourse, and having people look at them, I think, is important. Similar to what happened with Joseph DeAngelo, where there mm-hmm. were people that were pressing this case and saying that, you know, we're not giving up on this and we'll do what we can, whether we're sort of armchair detectives or just the general public, to solve these cases. They're not forgotten.
Yeah, it was very interesting in real time to be able to interview the detectives that were involved in the East Area Rapist case right from the very beginning, interview them again when it looked like something was happening with the FBI in terms of actually solving this case, which seemed incredible. It seemed almost unbelievable. And then speaking to those people involved, those detectives, after he was captured. It was just amazing, really, that breakthrough to be able to do something so incredibly. It was seemed almost unbelievable, I think, to people in the true crime genre, I think, for sure, certainly, and law enforcement.
Well, yeah, and that day in 2018 when he was arrested, my jaw hit the floor, and I was stunned, and I, you know, scrambled to find what I could online, and just it blew me away because it was from so long ago, 40 plus years, and the methods that they used to track him down were just incredibly fascinating. And I think it goes to show that law enforcement is working behind the scenes, and a lot of what we don't know, there may be things that are going on that we're not aware of, but I think
That's
keeping
right.
the public eye on things is always a good idea.
And I think you're right, too, that the case itself did so much for law enforcement morale and the FBI's reputation, and just gave so much hope to crime solving and the promise of DNA, which has been remarkable, really, comparative of all the other forensics procedures available. So I think it's there are so many dedicated people that can't let these cases go, very much like yourself, where you've invested in this investigation and you would like to see some dramatic results. And so I hope the very best for you. I want to thank you very much, Michael, for coming on and talking about the Flat Tire Murders, Unsolved Crimes of a South Florida Serial Killer. For people that might want to take a look, is there an Amazon page, a Facebook page? Tell us how they might take a look at this book more.
Sure, the book is available on Amazon. There's also an ebook version. I'm on Twitter at Flat Murders. I have Reddit and Facebook. So if people want to send me comments, I'm certainly available there. And I look forward to hearing from people. And I hope this book, is something that brings these cases to the public light.
Yes, it's an admirable endeavor. Thank you so much, Michael P. Burns, The Flat Tire Murders, Unsolved Crimes of a South Florida Serial Killer. It's been fascinating. Thank you so much, Michael. You have a great evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Dan. You too.